One of the things we got to remember or keep in mind is that scientists today, by and large, are interpreting the world through an atheistic worldview. Okay? They are simply trying to make sense of the world from that worldview. But it is impossible to interpret a world with a supernatural history through philosophical naturalism, and that's what they're trying to do. We got to keep that in mind. Now, evolutionists are not, you know, our enemies. They are not ignorant. These scientists, the scientists that support this view, very, very intelligent, and they are in, many of them are in agreement about these things, but we got to remember that to them, evolution is a fact. It is a fact and a theory. So it is a fact that it has happened. It is theoretical about how it happened. Whether it's through neo-Darwinian mechanisms or some other, evolution is a fact. They have basically turned the scientific method on its head. The scientific method starts with a hypothesis that you then work into a theory through experimentation. Once the theory has been further experimented and no variability is found, it is consistent through all, it's not falsifiable, then it may be elevated to a fact. Evolution has started as a fact. They accept it as a fact, though it's still theoretical about how it takes place. So we got to, keep these things in mind, and especially when we are deciding whether or not to accept this or not. But the subject of human evolution, at least today, is taught of as absolute fact in public schools and in mainstream media. It's just it's matter-of-fact kind of terminology. This quote comes from Prentice Hall Biology, the most commonly used biology textbook used in U.S. public schools today, pretty much without question. Humans and other primates evolved from a common ancestor that lived more than 65 million years ago. Between 6 and 7 million years ago, the hominoid line gave rise to a branch that ultimately led to the ancestors and closest relatives of modern humans. Matter of fact, it's not a theory. It's not one view. It's matter of fact. This is just how it happened. Evolutionists believe that all organisms on Earth have evolved from a single ancestral cell at a more local level, that humans and apes all share an ancestral hominoid that evolved first a long time ago. So humans, all of your apes, and in fact all of your monkeys all share some common ancestor. This is taught as a matter of fact today, as if that's just how it is. One of the things we want to consider, though, is it possible to really justify this view in light of the biblical, can we incorporate this within the biblical worldview? Now, a lot of Christians think that you can. There are a lot of Christians who try to interpret the days of creation as being long periods of time, but there's some serious problems with that. It's a very slippery slope that we get on. A couple of years ago, I watched a debate at actually one of the monthly meetings of the Creation Association of Puget Sound, one of the local groups here. I watched a video debate between John Mackay and John Polkinghorne. John Mackay is a young earth creationist missionary from Australia who was debating John Polkinghorne at Cambridge University. John Polkinghorne was currently, at that time, the dean of chapels. Prior to that, he had been the professor of physics there for 20 years. Went to seminary, came back as the dean of chapel, eminent scholar, theologian, scientist. He was taking the position of the theistic evolutionist. So John Mackay was taking the young earth position, John Polkinghorne the theistic evolution or old earth creation position. And one question that John Polkinghorne was asked was whether or not he believed Adam was a real man. And he said, no, I do not believe Adam was a real man. The name Adam just means man. And he summarized the story in the Garden of Eden as just a story to describe the nature of humanity. The problem with that is, if Adam wasn't a real man, who was? The Bible contains a genealogical record that runs from Adam and all the way through to Jesus. As a matter of fact, Luke himself repeats the genealogical record from Adam all the way to Jesus. If Adam wasn't a real man, when does the Bible become real? Who was the first real man if Adam wasn't? The history in Genesis progresses fairly rapidly. Genesis 1 through 3 are the Garden of Eden. Genesis 6 through 9 are the flood. Abraham enters the picture in Genesis 11. So if Genesis 1 is not real, Genesis 2 is not real, then when does it actually become real history? That's the slippery slope that we get on when we try to accept these theories. And remember that these theories about humans evolving from apes have been formed by scientists who are trying to interpret the world through philosophical naturalism, trying to interpret our world independent of a creation. So cannot be too quick to accept those theories, because Genesis is very clear. Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let him rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Not only did God create us distinct from the animals, but in his own image. So before we start looking at some examples of eight men that are accepted as being actual, we want to look at a little bit of history at where things have progressed from over the years. We'll start with Nebraska Man. In 1922, a fossil was discovered in Nebraska and was claimed as being a transitional hominid. And it was used in textbooks, colleges, and presented as evidence in the Scopes trial. You guys know what the Scopes trial is? ACLU puppet trial that was to challenge the Butler Act. Nebraska Man was used as presented as evidence in the scope trial. But they did not have a complete skeleton or a complete skull or even a complete jawbone. All they had was a single molar tooth. And that rendering was generated from that single molar tooth. A few years later, full investigation revealed that Nebraska Man was neither a man nor an ape, but actually the tooth turned out to belong to an extinct pig, a peccary. A dolphin rib was also, even more recently, claimed to be a fossil from a hominid. Tim White stated that a 5-million-year-old piece of bone that was thought to be the collarbone of a human-like creature is actually part of a dolphin rib. The problem with a lot of anthropologists is that they want so much to find a hominid that any scrap of bone becomes a hominid bone. He's an anthropologist at the University of California, Berkeley. He actually called this particular species of hominid Flipperpithecus. Ape men have been deduced from tiny fragments of bones, which actually belong not only to pigs and dolphins, but also alligators, horse, bear, elephant, and donkey. The London Times, Nigel Locke said, few sciences produce such abundant returns from so few fragments of fact as paleontology. In 1912, Piltdown Man was discovered by Charles Dawson in some gravel pits in Piltdown, England. It was announced that Darwin's missing link had been found. The discovery was published in the New York Times under the headline, Darwin's Theory Proved True. From 1912 to 1953, Piltdown Man reigned supreme in our textbooks and museums. Scores of books, pamphlets, and articles were published about Piltdown Man. 40 years later, the ape-like jawbone was found to be a fraud. The teeth had been filed down to make them more human-like. The bones had been treated with chemicals to increase their appearance of age. Still to date, it is uncertain who perpetrated the fraud, but most believe that Dawson must have been involved. This particular publication, became known as the March of Progress, was published in 1965 in a Time Life book series called Early Man by Clark Howell from the University of California. This is how it looked in its pre-fold-out version, but it was actually a 5-page fold-out that was mailed worldwide. This is arguably the most recognizable, the most famous scientific illustration ever made. It was mailed out worldwide as a publicity tool for the book to libraries, public libraries, and school libraries worldwide. Because of this, the poster itself, the 5-page pullout, ended up appearing in classrooms, science classrooms, social study classrooms, and libraries across the country. Stephen Jay Gould described it as a canonical representation of evolution, the one picture immediately grasped and viscerally understood by all. It is powerful visual proof of evolution. Such diagrams, probably more than anything else, convince the public that humans have evolved from apes. It was reproduced countless times. This is a modern reproduction. It was parodied countless times. The problem is that the diagram itself was knowingly misleading and fictitious. The apes and proto-apes pictured in this diagram never walked upright. Evolutionists knew at the time that they never walked upright. The book actually published that in the disclaimer. Although proto-apes and apes were quadrupedal, all apes shown here are shown here standing for a comparison. But unless you read the book, unless you read this fine print and the disclaimer, you would assume that the diagram itself was actual. And that's how it was interpreted. Stephen Jay Gould actually criticized the diagram, but not for its fictitious representations of apes, but for showing human evolution as being a linear progress rather than a branching pattern. The fact is that humans and apes are very distinct from one another. There are specific characteristics that distinguish the humans and apes. In particular, the fact that they have fine balance and they have a very flat face, an upright skull, straight back, fully extendable hip joints, angled femur, fully extendable knee joints, long legs. Most of these have to do with bipedal movement. Apes are quadrupeds, or what are known as knuckle walkers. But this is the general sequence of human evolution as it is currently presented, and you might recognize this diagram, our famous march of progress reproduced once again, but it shows Australopithecines evolving into Homo habilis, evolving into Homo erectus, evolving into Neanderthals, into Homo sapiens. Generally speaking, the creationists interpret these supposed ape mans like this. There are two genera, two taxonomic genera, known as Australopithecus, and the other genus known as Homo. Creationists generally believe that the Australopithecus genus, those are all true apes. And the Homo genus is comprised of true humans. Homo habilis is generally believed to be a composite made up of both ape and human bones. The actual sequence of human evolution, though, has changed dramatically over time. You can see in this diagram, in 1955, it shows Australopithecus evolving into Homo erectus and then into Homo sapiens, with Neanderthals not being one of our descendants. In 1967, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, then into Neanderthal and then to Homo sapiens. 1971, Australopithecus to Homo habilis, and neither Homo erectus or Neanderthals being our direct descendants, Homo habilis evolving directly into Homo sapiens. And then in 1980, Australopithecus into Homo habilis, into Homo erectus, and then to Homo sapiens. At this time, Neanderthals were considered the same species as ours. It was called Homo sapiens Neanderthalus. But it's changed even further. Now, I hate to muddy the water here, but the big current debate in paleontology today is between two main groups known as the multi-regional and the out of Africa theory. Okay? The multi-regional theory is the long-standing theory which said that Homo erectus had evolved in Africa, and then Australopithecus evolved into Homo erectus in Africa, and then these Homo erectus individuals migrated to various other continents, like Europe and Asia and in Australia. And after they migrated into these areas, they all independently evolved eventually into Homo sapiens. So Homo erectus evolved into Homo sapiens over a long period of time after they migrated into these various regions. But recently, a new theory has started to become widely accepted that has received strong support from mitochondrial DNA studies, the Africa Eve. Yeah, have you guys heard? So received some strong support from mitochondrial DNA studies that suggest, and this just seems very wild to me, but what they say is that, so Homo erectus had evolved in Africa and then it migrated to all of these various continents where we find Homo erectus fossils. But the Africa Homo erectus evolved into Homo sapiens, and then those Homo sapiens migrated into these various countries and outcompeted Homo erectus. So the Homo sapiens that now live in Europe, Asia, and in Australia are not related at all to the Homo erectus fossils they find in that area. Now, it's a very, very unusual theory. And Marvin Lubinow, in his book Bones of Contention, which is probably the single best work on paleoanthropology by a creationist, made a strong case that this particular theory, the singular purpose of this particular theory is to get rid of the inherent racism that has always been part of evolution. Because with this theory, depending on when the population evolved into Homo sapiens, they're going to be slightly more advanced than others. So you can have somewhat, this one slightly less advanced in this continent than in this one, and this was the justification for much of the racism that has taken place, such as the extermination of the Australian Aborigines, some terrible acts of racism because they thought that they were more savage versions of Homo sapiens, still not fully developed. But that's, anyway, I didn't want to go into that too much. So where do these ape men come? How do we get an ape man? If there are true ape men, half men and half ape, not apes or men, how do we get them? Well, you get them like this. Get them like this. So you combine fossils, human fossils with ape fossils and make a real ape man. You combine the two fossils together, which is what they have done in Homo habilis and in others. They take some human fossils, take some ape fossils, mix them together, call them to be the same, come from the same creature, and there you go. Another way you create an ape man, you emphasize the human-like qualities of ape fossils. And with some creative imagination, artistic licensing, you upgrade apes to look more human-like in diagrams and in illustrations. Or else you emphasize the ape-like qualities of human fossils. And with creative imagination, you downgrade the human fossils to be more ape-like. That's how you're creating an ape man. And several of them were created in just that way. I'll give you a couple of examples. But let's start with the big picture. Well, I'm going to look at the three main candidates for ape men, Australopithecines, Homo erectus, and Neanderthals, individually, just to kind of see how these really support evolution. The Australopithecines are best known by their type specimen, what was known as Lucy. Australopithecus afarensis is one of the species of Australopithecines. Lucy was discovered in 1974 in Ethiopia. It was about 40% complete, they say, just because they're not really counting all the bones in the hands and the feet. They claim that it walked upright. It's countless reproductions of Australopithecus afarensis can be found. This reconstruction is in the Las Vegas Natural History Museum. This reconstruction is in the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology at the University of New Mexico. The actual Lucy skeleton, the actual Lucy discovery, was here in Seattle not long ago. I took my creation apologetics class from Cedar Park to the exhibit. There were a couple things I found puzzling at the exhibit. Well, one interesting thing. So the Lucy was found in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopian government, for them to display Lucy, they also forced the displayers to also display the history of Ethiopia, which was almost entirely the Christian heritage of Ethiopia. I found that very interesting. The church history, the Christian history of Ethiopia, they forced them to include that along with the display of Lucy. But nowhere in the exhibit was there a full reconstruction of the bones that had been collected in total. Just Lucy. There was a model of Lucy, and there were the actual bones of Lucy, but nowhere was there a representation of the entire skeleton as it has been found so far. Nowhere. But the model itself was fairly large. Lucy was 3.5 feet tall. 3.5 feet tall. It's a little bitty thing. And although Lucy was not found with hands and feet, it is always modeled with very distinctly human hands and feet. This is a reconstruction at the Living World exhibit in the St. Louis Zoo. To take a little closer look at the hands and the feet, and notice the thoughtful gaze. peering off, pondering the complexities of the cosmos. Gravity. But it was known at the time this reconstruction was made that the fingers and toes of Afarensis, like Lucy, were very, very curved. Stern and Sussman, which are paleontologists at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, did a full investigation of Australopithecus afarensis, the hands and feet specifically, and they said a summary of the morphological and functional affinities of the hand fossils leads inexorably to an image of a suspensory-adapted hand, surprisingly similar to hands found in the small end of pygmy chimpanzees or the compan chimpanzee range, suspensory-adapted for hanging. There is no evidence, they say, that any extant primate has long, curved, heavily muscled hands and feet for any purpose other than to meet the demands of full or part-time arboreal life, tree dwelling. In an article titled "Lucy on the Ground with Knuckles," published in Science News and Nature, just so you know what the reference is about, and just if you don't, Lucy was named because apparently in the camp that night after it was discovered, they were playing "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," a Beatles song. So Lucy on the ground with Knuckles. Okay, you may have known that, but so they said Afarensis as well as Animensis, the latter represented by the famous skeleton known as Lucy, had wrists capable of locking the hands in place during knuckle walking. They were knuckle walkers, highly adapted for tree dwelling knuckle walkers. To look at some of the anatomy, the shoulder socket of Lucy faces skyward at an angle. In humans, it is vertically oriented. This indicates that Lucy lived more an arboreal lifestyle rather than tree dwelling. Her shoulder is more suited for brachiation in the trees, swinging from branch to branch by its arms. The pelvis of Australopithecus is also very much chimp-like. The iliac blades of the human go front to back, whereas in the apes, the iliac blades flare out laterally. The orientation is important for maintaining posture while walking upright. Stern and Sussman continue, the fact that the anterior portion of the iliac blade faces laterally in humans but not chimpanzees is obvious. The marked resemblance of Lucy to chimpanzee is equally obvious. It suggests to us that the mechanism of lateral pelvic balance during bipedalism was closer to that of apes than in humans. Oh, I'm going to have to apologize for this. I told our sound guy I was not going to need sound, but I realize that I am. So hopefully we can scramble, because I'm going to need you here in just a second. And I'm unplugging that. Hopefully. Okay. So what do you do if you have a fossil that is a quadruped that will not walk upright and you want to make it walk upright? One of the things you can do is you can do some reconstructive surgery on the fossil and get it to walk upright. Okay, that's one thing you do. Now, if you think I'm being a little facetious on this, well, I am in part, but in reality, this is exactly what has been done. In a 1994 PBS Nova series titled In Search of Human Origins, it features Dr. Owen Lovejoy's analysis and reconfiguration of Lucy.
The ape that stood up, it was a revolutionary idea. We needed Owen Lovejoy's expertise again, because the evidence wasn't quite adding up. The knee looked human, but the shape of her hip didn't. Superficially, her hip resembled a chimpanzee's, which meant that Lucy couldn't possibly have walked like a modern human. But Lovejoy noticed something odd about the way the bones had been fossilized.
When I put the two parts of the pelvis together that we had, this part of the pelvis has pressed so hard and so completely into this one that it caused it to be broken into a series of individual pieces, which were then fused together in later fossils.
So what they believed happened is that because the pelvis wouldn't allow Lucy to walk upright, they believe it must have been broken at some point and positioned in such a way, so he concludes.
This has caused the two bones, in fact, to fit together so well that they're in an anatomically impossible position.
To walk upright.
The perfect fit was an illusion that made Lucy's hip bones seem to flare out like a chimp's. But all was not lost. Lovejoy decided he could restore the pelvis to its natural shape. He didn't want to tamper with the original, so he made a copy in plaster. He cut the damaged pieces out and put them back together the way they were before Lucy died. It was a tricky job, but after taking the kink out of the pelvis, it all fit together perfectly, like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle.
Big hole in the thing. Grab a Cadillac through that thing.
As a result, the angle of the hip looks nothing like a chimp's, but a lot like ours.
A lot of problems with Lucy. The skull of Lucy is clearly not that of a human. It's got a sloping face typical of apes. Humans have a very, very flattened face in comparison. It's clearly more chimp-like. The attachment of the spine as well, if you see, compare where the spine attaches in humans right there, here to where Lucy attaches, it's clearly more chimp-like than human-like. It also has a large external ear hole like the apes, and internal analysis revealed that the semicircular canal, the canal inside the inner ear that's used for balance, is much more ape-like as well, typical of other knuckle walkers. The skull form of all Australopithecines is extremely ape-like, according to Ashley Montague, who is a British-American anthropologist who taught at Harvard, Princeton, Rutgers, University of California, and New York University. He continues, the Australopithecines show too many specialized and ape-like characters to be either the direct ancestor of man or of the line that led to man. Zuckerman in Beyond the Ivory Tower says, but I find myself totally unpersuaded. Zuckerman was a professor of anatomy at Birmingham University in England and was the chief scientific advisor to the British government. He says, almost always when I have tried to check the anatomical claims of which the status of Australopithecus is based, I have ended in failure. The Australopithecine skull is in fact so overwhelmingly simian as opposed to human that the contrary proposition could be equated to an assertion that black is white. Meaning stating that the Australopithecus is a human is like stating that black is white. It's that obvious. But what they do when they create their models and they create their reconstructions, despite what the evidence shows, they always make them look more human-like. So you take an ape fossil, you emphasize human-like characteristics, and with artistic license, you convert an ape-like skull to look more human-like. Now, what they have added here are some very clear human characteristics. The eyes in particular, very human-like. No apes have whites in their eyes showing. That's a distinctly human characteristic, as are the ears. And this was published actually in National Geographic in 1996. The person who created this reconstruction admits frankly that I wanted to get a human soul into this ape-like face to indicate something about where it was headed. Not where it was. You use artistic license to show where you believe it was headed. So Australopithecines have a number of characteristics that are all very ape-like. They have long arms, identical to chimpanzees. Jaws are similar to chimpanzees. Their upper leg bone is similar to chimpanzees. Their brain size, it overlaps the chimpanzees. Large back muscles for tree dwelling. Hands similar to pygmy chimpanzees. Foot, ape-like foot. Fingers and toes were long and curved. They had a locking wrist and an ankle bone that for tree dwelling. It was clearly ape-like. And finally, Charles Oxnard said, the Australopithecines, known over the last several decades, are now irrevocably removed from a place in the evolution of human bipedalism, possibly from a place in a group any closer to humans than to African apes, and certainly from any place in the direct human lineage. But still, they remain in the tree of life leading to humans. Neanderthals, also believed to be one of our direct ancestors, and then not our direct ancestors, and then our same species, and now again, Things seem to be completely up in the air between these two debating theories that I showed you previously. This is the original drawing of Neanderthal as it was sketched. The original reconstruction of Neanderthal. But it was realized to be incorrect. This initial reconstruction was discovered to be wrong. The brain capacity of Neanderthals is in fact 200 cc larger than humans. They used jewelry, they used musical instruments, they did cave paintings, they were capable of speech, they buried their dead. The Neanderthal anatomy is unique in a way from humans. They had thick skulls and brow ridges. They also had stocky body builds and short extremities. They were big game hunters living in cold, harsh climates. They find them with mammoth tusks and these kind of things. So they were large, big game hunters. But what you do when it looks very human-like is you do some reconstruction to make it look more ape-like. Jack Cuozzo, who was a retired orthodontist, managed to do some x-ray analysis of several Neanderthal skulls in France and Germany. He published some of the results in a book titled Buried Alive, which you should be able to find in the back. He actually found this diagram and the souvenir counter at the museum in Berlin. And what he realized right away, being a retired orthodontist, is that the jaw of this on this diagram is out of socket, a full 30 millimeters forward to make it look more ape-like, because the big distinction between the human skull and the ape skull is that the human skull is very, very flat in comparison, and the apes have a muzzle. Now, what they usually find as far as fossils are concerned is just the brain, the cap, the skull cap, and the mandible, the lower jaw. So they get the skull cap, they get the lower jaw, and then they figure out how ape-like is this or how human-like is this, just based on where they think that jaw fits with the skull cap. It's just a matter of where you believe that organism fit in human evolution. It's as simple as that. A detailed comparison of Neanderthal skeleton remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans. Tinkus is an anthropologist at Washington University and an expert in Neanderthal biology and evolution. Sodera, who is also a human anatomist and with three books on surgical techniques, said, despite their stocky body build and their stocky skull shape, there is no hard evidence to say that Neanderthals were in any way inferior intellectually to modern man. They were known to have made sophisticated flint tools to build huts of animals out of animal skins and had control of fire. They also buried their dead. The burial of dead has been recognized for a long time to be a very religious act. Marvin Lubinow, in his book, in this Journal of Creation article, Recovery of Neanderthal Mitochondrial DNA, says that most anthropologists recognize burial as a very human and very religious act. But the strongest evidence that Neanderthals were fully human and of our own species is that at four sites, Neanderthal and modern humans were buried together. Neanderthals are now recognized in more modern reconstructions to be very human-like. This is a reconstruction at the Neanderthal Museum in Germany, and another of the famous Gibraltar II child at the University of Zurich. They were clearly human-like, clearly human-like. Homo erectus, the first Homo erectus fossil found was Java Man, found on Java Island off the coast of Indonesia. It was discovered in 1891 by Eugene Dubois. Models and replicas of it were circulated for decades. This particular diagram is from 1922, though the initial discovery was made in 1891. You notice that they have a full skull and a model of the face, a sculpture of the face, but what they actually found was just the skull cap, a single femur, and a single tooth. The story behind this discovery is kind of interesting. Dubois was Ernest Haeckel's former student. Ernest Haeckel was formerly known as Darwin's bulldog. And Ernest Haeckel had already assumed that that a missing link like this would be found, and had already named it Pithecanthropus. And Eugene Dubois was set out to find the missing link that his former professor believed existed, and was the first person to ever intentionally look for ape-man fossils, the first person to ever do so. But he wasn't a paleontologist, he was actually a human anatomist, had no training in geology or in excavations, and he actually didn't make the discovery himself. He was actually, if I remember correctly, was a medical officer in a Dutch East India Corps. And while there, managed to get permission to search for human fossils in his spare time. So I guess the Corps had a lot of spare time. He was assigned two corporals and like 50 forced laborers to search for human fossils. Two corporals from the engineering corps were overseeing 50 forced laborers searching for this fossil. So there was very poor evidence as far as the specific strata in which these were found. And most experts, even of the time, did not agree that the femur belonged with the skull cap. The skull cap itself was very primitive in that there were brow ridges evident on it, but the femur itself was very modern. And the flora and fauna of the strata, that as it was later investigated, had very modern constituents as well. So this was questioned almost from the very beginning. Next most famous Homo erectus discovery was probably Peking Man. I think this monument says a lot. This monument is outside of the cave complex where Peking Man was found. I mean, good grief. How significant are these discoveries when you end up building a monument to the entry of the cave complex where this thing was found? I know it says a lot. Modern models of Homo erectus today look very much human-like. It is now recognized that Homo erectus was very much human. Marvin Lubinow published a number of characteristics of Homo erectus. Its cranial capacity, for example, was somewhere between 720 and 1250, but this falls within the range of modern humans. The big difference between the apes and the humans is cranial capacity. Australopithecus, if memory serves, is somewhere between 3 and 600 cc's, very, very small in comparison. Modern human cranial capacity ranges from 700 all the way up to 2200. So the Homo erectus cranial capacity ranges slightly lower than the average in modern humans, but still well within the range. Otherwise, most of these other characteristics have to do with the thickness of the bones in the skull. They had very, very thick skulls, as did Neanderthals. But up until recently, no valid comparison had been done between Homo erectus skulls and modern humans to see how well they overlapped. So this was very recently done, and the researchers published their work in 1994. They said, now that comparable data is available, it appears clear that if Homo sapiens include all the people alive in the world today, their ancestors in the late Pleistocene and the archaic Homo sapiens, then vault thickness cannot be used to distinguish Homo erectus with Homo sapiens. They analyzed some modern Asian populations, some Australian aborigines, and compared those with Homo erectus and found that there was a significant overlap. In general, the Homo erectus skulls are thicker, but you still can find modern humans with skulls in that range as well. In 2008, there was a discovery of a pelvis that showed that the infant Homo erectus also had a head much larger than it was previously believed to be, had a much larger cranial capacity than was previously thought. Well, just below, but right at the edge of the modern human cranial capacity. This is a National Science Foundation graphic from a 2008 discovery. Marvin Lubinow's book, which again I think is very, very, very significant, one of the most significant works in creation paleontology, makes a strong argument against human evolution by showing that modern human fossils have been found that extend the entire range of what they consider to be hominoid evolution. The full length of time that Neanderthals have been around, they have found modern humans. In fact, Neanderthals and modern humans buried together, the full length of the time that Homo erectus fossils have been found, modern Homo sapien fossils are found right along with them. And in fact, there's a cave in Spain where they literally found hundreds. It apparently, there was a large pit inside of a cave that was apparently a burial place for a long period of time, and they found a great number of Homo erectus and modern Homo sapiens skulls mixed together. And for Homo habilis as well, modern Homo sapiens skull fossils have been found that date to the same times, based on evolutionary dates. So, I mean, there's a serious problem with what they're putting forth. But when they tend to show their evolutionary charts, they will always show Homo habilis as existing just before Homo erectus and Homo erectus existing just before modern Homo sapiens. But it just doesn't match with the data. So what do we make of this, these ancient post-flood these ancient humans that we find, Neanderthals and Homo erectus in particular, are believed by most creationists that have investigated this to simply be the post-flood humans. Humans that lived after the flood and after the division at the Tower of Babel, or Babel, if you prefer that pronunciation. Marvin Luminow, in fact, believes that Homo erectus and Homo Neanderthals are the same. My own conclusion is that Homo erectus and Neanderthals are actually the same. Homo erectus is at the lower end with regard to size of a continuum that includes Homo erectus, early Homo sapiens, and Neanderthal. The range of cranial capacities for fossil humans is in line with the range of cranial capacities for modern humans. So the Homo erectus skull looks basically identical to Neanderthal skulls. It's just a bit smaller. They were two different populations of post-flood humans, one just slightly smaller than the other. Peter Line in Journal of Creation says that without the burden of having to fit fossils into an evolutionary scheme, there is no reason not to accept fossils such as those categorized as erectus and Neanderthals as belonging to one humankind. They were true humans. If fossils such as those categorized as Homo erectus and Neanderthals were all fully human, then the case for human evolution essentially collapses, as there is an unbridgeable morphological gap between the Australopithecine apes and these humans. He continues. Differences in skeletal and anatomy may simply reflect a greater genetic diversity. So how are we explaining this difference? What is the difference in erectus and Neanderthal morphology? What caused this different morphology? There are a number of theories that have been put forth. It could be simple genetic diversity within the humankind in the past. And in some instances, it could be living conditions under the particularly harsh environmental conditions after the flood, or even different dietary habits after the flood or after the Tower of Babel that may have influenced skeletal development. The stress of particular biomechanical forces as well as pathology, some of it could be clearly disease-related. These may also have influenced skull and postcranial morphology in some instances. He continues with what is I have seen published by several authors, though, that the main reason for the difference in the skull of erectus and Neanderthal, the thickness of the skull may in fact be due to longevity. Remember that humans before the flood lived to be much older than modern humans. So humans before the flood lived to be on average close to 900 years old. And then after the flood, the life expectancy of humans dropped off rapidly, but there were still several generations where it reached well over 400 years in age. And the bones of the skull continue to grow as you age. And so it is very possible that these Homo erectus skulls and these Homo Neanderthal skulls are simply some of these post-flood peoples that were living alongside others that simply were much, much older. So you had some people that were 400 years old living right alongside others that were only 50 years old. And when those peoples died, you ended up with some that had skulls that were very thick and some that had skulls much more closer to modern humans. Okay? So in summary, you know, I think we can conclude that the missing link is still missing. That there is really no credible evidence for human evolution from apes, and we need to be very skeptical about these claims when they surface. Then God said, let us make man in our image.